The Bain Free Radio Hour.
On the podcast, Earchs and Monarchs, Changelings on the Road to Hell, and the Rest is Silence. Plus, we continue with our complete audiobook serialization of John Ringo's Under a Graveyard Sky. All right now. Welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour podcast. It's an honor to have you along. I'm Bain editor Tony Daniel. This time we have an interview with Brandon Du Bois talking about his debut science fiction novel, Dark Victory. This is a really hard-driving novel of fighting back against alien invaders who have devastated Earth. It's told from the perspective of a 16-year-old who is one of the best recon rangers out fighting the alien creepers. Most of the older soldiers have been killed off, and it's mostly teenagers fighting the war now. Also, there's a great boy and dog love story in there. Brendan is a noted mystery writer, but this is his first SF novel, and he brings a lot of those suspense and thriller chops to it. We also continue with our complete audiobook serialization of John Ringo's Under a Graveyard Sky. Now the news. The new Earchs are out. Now, an Earch is a device for tunneling through the Earth's surface to the plastic magma beneath and tapping it for use in geothermal amusement park rides, of which there are none because nobody's done it yet. No. An Earch is an electronic advanced reading copy. It's an upcoming book after copy editing but before proofreading, so that there are typos and other infelicities therein, but you get it months early. Which is especially cool if you are a fan of a particular series, and this is the next book in it. January Earchs include Hey, The Road to Hell by David Weber and Joel Presby. The Multiverse series returns at last. The war between magically gifted Arcana and psionically talented Sharona continues to rage. Remember, Sharona is also kind of steampunky. And David Weber and new collaborator Joel Presby tell the story. It's really epic. It's a big old great addition to that series. Hey, the Serrated Edge series is back as well. Here we have teenager Stacy, who is about to discover that there are some deep secrets in the seemingly sleepy town of Silence, Maine. Elvish secrets, of course. This is the series about elves and elf politics in the modern-day setting. And it was always a lot of fun to see how the elves would deal with their elfy natures in the present in the previous books in the series. Now we've got new entries to look forward to. Also out is Shooting the Rift by Alex Stewart. This is a new space opera. It's a debut novel in America for Alex Stewart. It's a story about Simon Forrester, who's been cast out by his family and exiled from the Rimworld Commonwealth. And he has to make a new life for himself as an apprentice to the powerful Commerce Guild. Simon finds himself forced to choose between old and new loyalties, and the fate of the Empire is at stake. Sounds like a great space opera plot to me. Alex is a Brit who's published quite a few gaming-related books over in Britain. And now out is Changeling's Island by Dave Freer. In this one, teenager Tim Ryan comes into his own as he faces danger on a remote Australian island where magic lurks in land and sea. This is really a great novel by Dave. It crosses Aboriginal Australian magical ways with Irish magic. It's set on Flinders Island, which is the very island David lives on off the coast of Australia. And I think it's a fantastic read. I really loved it when it came in. And I encourage you to check it out. So get them early and read the future. Earchs for Changeling's Island, Shooting the Rift, Silence, and the Road to Hell are now available only at BaneEbooks.com. And, of course, they are sold in all formats, including for the Kindle. Many people seem to not realize it is perfectly easy to get an ebook at BaneEbooks onto their Kindles. It is, and I find myself telling people this at conventions a lot, so definitely, you can read it on any device that's out there. I want to welcome Brendan DuBois to the podcast. Hey, Brendan.
Hey, Tony. How goes it?
Brendan is the award-winning author of 20 or so novels. He's probably got an accurate count at this point. Do you? Is it 18?
It's 20.
20. Hey, I got it right.
Yes,
and
sir.
Over 150 short stories. Exactly 150 short stories, something.
Exactly 151 now.
A damn lot of short stories. His short stories have twice won the Seamus Award from the Private Eye Writers of America and 3 Edgar nominations. Brendan lives in New Hampshire. He's a former Jeopardy champion, and he's recently appeared on and won the game show The Chase, I think it's called. Brendan recently co-authored a book with the redoubtable James Patterson, too, by the way. And now Brendan's debut science fiction novel is at booksellers everywhere, and that is Dark Victory, novel of the alien resistance. So you just finished up your work on the Patterson. I'd like to ask you about that first, maybe. It's not exactly a machine, this Patterson prolific process for creating lots of thrillers. I've read that working with him is actually pretty pleasant from some of the other writers. How was it for you?
Extraordinarily pleasant. Very professional, very smooth, very exhilarating. And it went very, very well. I couldn't have asked for more. I was thrilled to be asked. I jumped at the opportunity. And when you get word that he is pleased with your product, well, that makes your day.
Do you pitch the idea to them, or do they tell you something that they, or him?
I had sent them a writing sample based on one of my short stories, and they liked that writing sample so much, they said, why don't I expand this short story into a longer work? And I said, that works for me. And they asked for sample chapters and an outline. And once that was approved, it was just hitting the keyboard every day.
Cool. Well, maybe it wouldn't work that way for every writer, but you have that facility of, especially your thrillers. Before we get to Dark Victory, I want to ask you about your mysteries. You've written a bunch of mystery books. Your main series is Lewis Cole. How did you get started writing in the mystery genre?
Funny story, I sort of backed into it. Science fiction was always my first love. I grew up in the 60s and early 70s, just devouring everybody from Arthur C. Clarke to Heinlein to Larry Niven and everybody in between. I really wanted to be a science fiction author. And I started to try to break in with short stories, and I kept on getting the traditional rejection until one day I'd written a story that was somewhat mysterious, and I sent it off to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, and they bought it. And I sort of went down that path for a long time, but never losing my love for science fiction, which is why I was so thrilled when I had the idea for Dark Victory and I wrote it and you and Tony bought it. Well, it was definitely a dream come true. So right now I'm straddling both genres and trying to produce good stuff in each. And it's a challenge, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I've read and reviewed your Lewis Cole novel. One of them, and I've read several of them since then in the series. One more thing about it, that relentless sort of character who just won't stop, even though the bad guys are, and the good guys are indifferent to him, and the bad guys are seemingly win. That seems to be a theme that you carry across your fiction. That's sort of like Randy in Dark Victory, right? He's kind of a young Lewis Cole, perhaps.
Sort of a person who fights for what he, or even she, thinks is right. And no matter the odds, no matter the challenge, just won't give up. And I think that's what attracts readers, I hope, to my characters, is seeing someone who's not perfect, who's flawed, who does make mistakes, but picks himself up again and says, okay, let's keep on hitting, let's keep on hammering. And I think that's true for Randy, my main character in Dark Victory. He goes through a lot of challenges and setbacks in Dark Victory, and he just won't give up.
Well, tell us about the genesis of Dark Victory. When did you come up with the idea? Did you write it? Is there an original version? Is this something that's been around a while, or is it relatively recent?
A few years back, I was in between thrillers and Lewis Cole series, and I hate having a blank page staring at me. I always have to be writing. And I said, well, let's take this opportunity to write a pure science fiction novel. And the idea I had was just a young boy in the back of an old National Guard truck riding into battle with his faithful dog, canine companion, and a young lady who's his girlfriend. And I just had that idea right there, just had that vision. I started writing it. And all you kids out there, be careful, because I didn't outline. I basically wrote it, you know, okay, what are we going to do next? What are we going to do next? And creating this world on its own. And as you know, the first draft that you and Tony Weisskopf looked at was kind of lean by a few more chapters. We had to, like, flesh things out, which I agreed. And I think the book now is a much better book than the one I first submitted to you. I wrote it on the fly, no outline. And it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun.
Well, the prose is relentless and driving, and just, the story just propels you forward, like kicks you almost forward.
But thank you.
We're immediately thrown into this post-alien apocalypse world. Things like cell phones and the internet are a thing of the past. Our main character can't even remember them, really. What's the technology level as we start the book, and why is it there?
Good question, because that's sort of one of the mysteries, is why are the aliens here and why did they do what they did to us? To start off, when I was working on the book, I thought most alien invasion books start with chapter one, page one, things are peaceful on Earth, and oh my God, there's lights in the sky, and here come the aliens. I wanted to set it 10 years in the future, where we've been fighting them for 10 years, basically losing, having a few victories here and there, such that most of the people who are doing the fighting are teenagers, because most of the adults have died off. And when the aliens came, that are called the Creepers in the book, one of the first things they did was set off nuclear detonations in our upper atmosphere, sending out an EMP pulse that fried every electronic, basically tossing us back into early 20th century technology. So in a funny way, they're fighting aliens, interstellar aliens, using steam trains, coal-powered vehicles, and horses. And sometimes they use trench warfare, like back in World War One. And I just thought that was a great contrast, where you're having interstellar war, and basically humans are fighting it, outnumbered and pretty much outgunned technologically.
Yeah, and the things that, like electric things, that they have, they're easily detected, that's the reason, and destroyed, right? The aliens have hunter-killer satellites, right?
They have what's called killer stealth satellites in orbit. You can't see them, you can't detect them, but they're always observing on Earth. So if someone was to find, you know, an F-14 aircraft in a hangar somewhere and manage to power up and start flying, within seconds it would be blasted out of the sky. And the same thing for a computer. If you turn on a computer, chances are you and everything around it will be dead. It seems like the aliens want to keep us at this level of technology. And again, that's one of the mysteries of the book. Why are they here and why they're doing what they're doing? And while I reveal an answer here and there, I'm still keeping a lot of stuff back, as we devious authors do.
Mm-hmm. Well, what the Creepers, what can you tell us about? What are their capabilities? How do they kill people?
Sure. The Creepers came to Earth via a comet. Well, astronomers thought it was a comet that was making odd maneuvers, and it seemed like it was going to come close to Earth. And that's when the Creepers revealed themselves. They went in orbit around Earth. They started bombarding with the nuclear detonations, followed by carefully placed asteroids that were dropped into major oceans and lakes so that major coastal cities were hit by tsunamis. And then they dropped into space from space and set up nearly impenetrable dome bases on Earth. And that's where they exist. Every now and then the domes open up and the Creepers come out and raise hell. But they don't do it in what we would think would be a logical manner. As one character says, if they really wanted to kill us all, they could have just devised a bio-warfare and have the whole planet to themselves. But they come out and they attack, or sometimes they're on some oddball mission that no one can understand. But they are shaped like a scorpion, an arthropod, about the size of a school bus. And their two claws can be used for a cutting weapon, for a laser beam, for a flame weapon. And the arthropod is basically, for lack of a better word, like a tank. And inside is the actual alien Creeper, who is protected. And as the book opens up, one of the things you learn is that we have determined a way of killing the Creepers by firing a binary grenade at them that envelops them in a gas cloud that can kill them. But you have to get up close to like 50 or so meters away, which makes for very dangerous infantry fighting, as you learn as the book proceeds.
I kept thinking of those gas grenades as sort of gas epoxy somehow, because you always get the two chemicals you have to combine. Anyway, they had the they have a feel of, to me, like John Christopher's tripods in the White Mountains, etc., and H.G. Wells, of course. What are your influences? Did they arise from some of that? Was that in your collective background?
I think subconsciously, maybe the bugs in Robert Heinlein's Starship Troopers.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted something so alien that one of the great puzzles as the book goes on is why they're here, why they're doing it. And the answer, of course, is they're aliens.
It's really cool that they do odd things, because that's the, like, one of them that gets destroyed is carrying a bunch of bones. Like,
exactly.
And it's like, what the hell? Why do they, what's so important about this? And
important about bones.
It's really cool that, I mean, it really makes them feel more alien, because you don't know what they're going to do next.
Right. And in one of the subplots of the book, in some cities across the globe, including Denver, they set up a perimeter. It's a no-go zone, and these cities are being starved like Leningrad back in World War II. Again, why? Nobody knows.
By the way, I would say we have the a short story at Bain.com if you want to get a taste of the world, called The Siege of Denver, right?
Exactly. It's a short little story not involving any characters of the book, but it takes place outside of Denver during the Siege of Denver and gives you a taste of what humanity is up against as they fight the creepers.
So Sergeant Randy Knox, he's a ragged veteran in the fight against the creepers, but how old is he?
He's 16. He's a sergeant in the New Hampshire National Army Guard, which is, of course, an army unit, but for practical purposes and for reasons of honor, they like to keep their own names. And he's what's called a recon ranger. He's assigned a canine unit, and they go out and hunt the creepers, basically, if they're out there. He's stubborn. He's independent. He's injured. He lost part of his hearing in one of his ears from an attack some years earlier. He lost his wife, his mom and his older sister during the attack 10 years prior. He has very few memories of them. And his father is a colonel in Army Intelligence. And they live on an Army base outside of Concord, New Hampshire, what used to be a prep school called St. Paul's. And as the book opens up, the rumor is that the war is over because the Creepers had what was called an orbital base orbiting the Earth that sort of kept control of the domes, kept control of the killer stealth satellites, and in a very brave and almost suicide mission, the Air Force has managed to destroy it. And so the feeling is, oh boy, the war's over. We've won. But as you go through the book, you realize, well, it takes two to make a peace, and maybe the other side doesn't realize that they've lost the war. And so the fighting does continue.
Yeah, and they are really hard to kill.
They're very hard to kill. The only thing that can really kill them is a nuclear device. But the problem with nuclear devices, of course, is that they're all electronics and high-tech, which means they can't be used, or the binary gas grenade that is basically used by infantry that have to come up close. And once the gas grenade explodes near the creepers, they are killed by it, and it's a poison gas. But unfortunately, as the book opens, they've not been able to get it into larger shells, so it's basically, like I said, an infantry weapon.
I love that as the book opens, that after Randy's been out hunting creepers, he comes back and he has to do a geometry test first.
Yeah, isn't that funny?
So what's the situation like? What is Randy's life like as the novel begins?
Randy is stationed at the Army base Fort St. Paul, and he's a recon ranger, but also he's required to go to school. One of the things I mentioned offhand is that as the war went on, the losses were so tremendous, the surviving Congress lowered the enlistment age to 12. And that was passed only under the guise that, well, we have to school them as well. So he can be out hunting creepers at night, risking his life, and have a term paper due the next day. So it's a bit of conflict. And also he's 16, you know, he's concerned about his appearance, he's concerned about girls. But most of all, no, he's concerned about surviving. And again, as the book opens up, he's thinking to himself, okay, if the war is over, and all I've known since my age of 6 was the war, and I've been fighting the creepers since I was 12, what else am I good for? What will I do once the war is over?
He's also got a partner of sort and a best friend who's a Belgian Malinois, I think. I guess that's the way you say it.
It looks like a German Shepherd, but it's not.
This is a common military dog in military and law enforcement use now, isn't it?
Correct. And what I thought was, well, nice to have a canine unit who's trained to sniff out creepers, can warn them when they're approaching.
They have a very distinct odor, right?
Very distinct odor. And what I had fun with is that Randy was told that his dog, Thor, is a direct descendant of the Belgian Malinois named Cairo that went in with the SEALs and they killed Osama bin Laden. And as the book opens up, Randy reflects on that and says, you know, what the SEALs faced back then is nothing compared to what we're facing right now. It's much more deadly, much more dangerous. But he's proud to have Thor with him. And Thor is a character in and of himself. And he's devoted to Randy. Even when Randy tells him to stay or not accompany him, Thor will not listen. And they're a team. What can I say? They're a team.
Yeah. And Randy is just as devoted to Thor as well.
Exactly. According to rules and regulations, he's supposed to put Thor back into the base kennels at night. But he always comes up with a lie or excuse that he's preparing for a night training mission or Thor has to rest up or something. So usually he spends the night in Randy's bed in his barracks.
Randy is a thoughtful fellow underneath it all. The book is, I mean, he's 16, but he's also, he's sort of a beginning writer. And there's journal entries that are throughout that are basically flashbacks to give us more insight. But they're also, they must have been fun to write because they're little vignettes, right, that you could communicate about.
Well, that flesh out his character and also flesh out the universe that they're living in. And every now and then there's a bit of memory. Like, one of his prized possessions in his barracks room is an old cell phone that doesn't work. And he just remembers being a kid, being able to call up his mom anytime and talk about things and what life was like. And you know, those are some of the vignettes. And there's also stories about, you know, what was it like growing up? What was it like training? And sort of observations about the world. And I use that to sort of give a break in the action and sort of to give people more of understanding of what the universe is like in this world and what Randy's role is in it.
Speaking of that, that the cell phone, there's just like this heart, you know, tearing up moment in the book when he had, after his mom disappeared, he would like pretend like he was calling her, right? His dad noticed that.
Yeah, over and over again, yeah.
That really just like hit home. What's happened to him, what kind of life he's in. He's had a rough life. He's given an assignment, and actually two assignments near the start of the book. What are these, and where are they supposed to take him?
Well, he has an assignment where he is supposed to escort assistant to the governor of Hampshire to the nation's capital, which, as this book opens up, the nation's capital is in Albany, New York. Of course, Washington and other major cities were hit during the first week of invasion. And I think Albany is like the sixth or seventh location for the nation's capital. And he has been asked to escort this gentleman from Concord, the New Hampshire state capital, to Albany, the nation's capital, and just protect him and protect a dispatch case that he's carrying. But on the day that he's leaving in the train station in Concord, a young woman comes up named Serena, who's with her brother Buddy, who's 12, and his uncle, who is the post commander, has asked him to also bring them to Washington, D.C. And what you find out is that these two apparently innocent and upward, straightforward missions are anything but. And as they head to D.C., there's an ambush, and they are forced to survive on their wits and their survival skills in, you know, what is the harsh wilderness of a post-apocalyptic world.
What are the means of transportation they were thinking they were going to take to get to the capital? Since we don't have...
Train.
Go ahead. Yeah, train. A train that is powered not by diesel fuel, right? Or is it?
No, it's powered by coal.
Yeah.
And so there's also a number of cars from the 1960s back that have very simple, if any, electronic, and some diesel trucks and some diesel engines, just because they don't have the electronics. But there's sort of a, we'll say, a level at which electronic usage will make you a target. For example, most of the Navy is gone, but they're rebuilding steel dreadnoughts with steam. And the Air Force has really not been seen since the war began because they get shot out of the sky whenever they emerge from a hangar or a base. So, and they using telegraph and some of the telephones back, mail services back. But the big industries now is agriculture, just to keep the people fed.
Yeah. There's also like steam-powered buses too, which I thought were kind of cool to think about.
Right, steam-powered buses, you know, powered by wood or coal. It's sort of like back in France during the occupation when Germans occupied it, they were running buses on practically anything they could get their hands on, you know, any type of coal or wood or pellets, you know, just to keep things propelled.
So Serena and Buddy are Randy's mysterious traveling companions, and despite poor Abby back home, who's Randy's girlfriend, Serena becomes a potential love interest. He's 16, come on.
Abby Monroe, who's a combat dispatcher, she rides on mountain bikes to pass messages from one unit to the next. But Serena, Abby, who is his girlfriend, is part of the unit, and she's a rough-and-tumble, tomboyish kind of young lady. But Serena is carefully dressed, wears a little makeup, and just looks stunning. And he just can't keep his eyes off of her, even though she can be a real pain in the butt. And her brother, Buddy, is mute, doesn't say a word, can dress himself, can eat, and appear otherwise normal, but he won't say a word. And he is a key to this book, and I'd say he's a key in future works.
The thing I like about Serena is that her sort of vanity is explained. She makes that an impassioned speech about, God damn it, she wants to get those good old days back, and she will.
She wants. Yeah, she flips through an old issue of 17 magazine and said, look, this is what I want. I want makeup. I want toys. I want an iPhone. I want to be fed every day. I want, you know, to worry about just dating. I'm tired of this existence. I'm tired of being in the Army. I'm tired of dirt under my fingernails. I'm tired of being hungry all the time. There's sort of like the millennial generation. There's a generation here, I think I call the straddlers at some point, where they're growing up, but they still have those dim memories of a golden age. And it's very bittersweet, very melancholy.
I love the onrushing feel of your prose. That's really the thing that first just absolutely struck Tony and I when we were reading the book. Every page packs a punch. Can you tell us a little bit about your writing process? I mean, you already have, but...
Sure. Well, part of my writing comes from my early years training when I was a journalist, where you're basically taught, and sometimes brutally, to tell the story and tell it quick and get the reader's attention. And I think I've carried that over my fiction writing. I'm a storyteller. I'm very proud to be a storyteller. And I want to grab a reader's throat at the very first pages or chapter and not let go to the end. And at the end, I want the reader to say, whoa, what a ride that was. And I'm proud of that. And I think when I work and I'm writing a story, I am focused on keeping it as entertaining, as informative, and as lean as possible. Because I realize that readers have many things calling and interrupting their attention. And I want my works to sort of stand up above the noise and be noticed.
I see, I follow you on Facebook, and I see you constantly talking about how you squeeze in moments of writing. It's like being a fish in the ocean with you, right? You don't not write.
I do not write. I write every day. Christmas, holidays, birthdays, 4th of July. I cannot not write. Some days I write more than others, and I'll have a laptop in my lap early evening, you know, catching up on email, writing down story ideas, and I'm fortunate in that I love what I do. For me, writing has always been my calling, and like I say in the Bible, sometimes there's 7 lean years and sometimes 7 fat years, and the thing is to stick it out when things are not going right, because there's so many opportunities for things not to go right, and I just keep my head down and just keep on plugging. And I'm fortunate that I get to the keyboard every day and I jump in, and I've never had a writer's block. Well, strike that. Once back in the 1980s, I had a day when I couldn't write anything, and that was it. So I've been very fortunate that way.
Well, you seem like the process is so enjoyable to you that you're not one of these writers that likes having written but finds the agony in the process, right?
Not really. I enjoy the creative process. I really do. If there's anything about the process that drives me berserk, it's the business end, no offense.
Mm-hmm.
With deadlines.
We would all say that, even whichever end we're on.
Yeah. So I love the creative process. I like revising. I enjoy it all, and I am always fortunate that I have a full plate, and I'm never bored. I may be tired, I may be dragging things, but I'm never bored.
Well, speaking of a full plate, we would be remiss in not mentioning your game show resume. Can you tell us, how was Jeopardy and The Chase? Are you going to do more of these? How the hell did you get involved with that?
Yeah, well, I've always been a trivia buff. I love watching Jeopardy. And a few years back, I said, let's give it a shot. And I tried the online test, and nothing happened. And then a year later, they said, here's the online test. And so I took the online test again, and I passed it. Of course, that's one of the big secrets of Jeopardy is they never tell you what the cutoff is, but I felt pretty good when the test was done. And they called me down to Boston for a interview, and we play a couple mock games. And I just put on a good, upbeat face, and they liked what they saw. In the summer of 2012, I went out to Hollywood, and I played. They taped 5 shows a day, and my show was the 5th one taped, and much to my surprise, I was the champion. And they flew me back the following week, and everybody called you champ. How you doing, champ? Have you had breakfast, champ? And then I went to my second game where I proceeded to get my ass handed to me on a silver platter. But it was still a wonderful experience. I wrote a nonfiction book about it called My Short Happy Life in Jeopardy. And then a year or so later, someone said, hey, The Chase is auditioning. So I auditioned for The Chase, and I got into that one, and that was a blast, too. I tried out for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. I made the cut and was put in the contestant pool, but the contestant pool is now, after a year, if you haven't been heard from, they say, try again. So I'll try again. And there's another show coming up called 500 Questions, which I'll try out for, too. It's a hoot. What can I say? I enjoy answering questions. I enjoy the whole process. And if you win, that's a good chunk of extra change that you didn't anticipate. That can be pretty sweet.
Yeah, sure. Too bad the current Powerball is not based on trivia. I think it's up over $1 billion. You would probably still keep writing. Even if you won $1 billion on a game show, you'd probably still keep turning out books, wouldn't you, Brendan?
I would. I've told family and friends, I say, well, when are you going to retire? And I've always said the same thing. I will stop writing the day I hear the dirt clumping on top of my coffin cover.
Well, there's definitely going to be a sequel to Dark Victory. Can you give us a hint about some teasing about what's going on with the series?
Sure. The second book is called Red Vengeance. It takes place literally the day after Dark Victory ends. And Randy and his canine unit, he's beat up, he's tired, he's injured. All he wants to do is go back to his home base in Concord and just, like, sleep for a week. But as happens in the Army intervenes and says, nope, we need you to do a mission for us. And I won't tell you what the mission is, but he needs to stay in New York State and do the mission. And he's assigned to a company of regular Army from the 10th Mountain Division. And it's led by a woman captain named Carol Wallace, who's a direct descendant of William Wallace of Braveheart fame. And it's K Company, so they're known as Kyra's Killers. And he finds it odd being part of a regular Army unit because he's National Guard. And he finds it hard to fit in. And then things just start going from bad to worse to even more worse. Mm. Pretty soon, this company is being chased by the Creepers in a running battle. And let me tell you, it's pretty exciting, nail-biting stuff, if I say so myself.
Cool.
And right now, I'm in the middle of revising it. And as they say, God willing, the Kirk don't rise, I should get it to my most wonderful editor in a month or so.
So is that what you're working on these days?
Well, that and a few other things. I always have a couple of short stories simmering. I am started outlining another Lewis Cole mystery, and so I'm doing that. And also, I owe you an outline of a couple of several chapters for proposed alt history books. So
that's right. You've done 2 alt histories before that.
I have. Resurrection Day, which looked at what would have happened if the Cuban Missile Crisis had become a war back in 1962. An American Eagle, which is what would have happened to the United States and the world if FDR had been assassinated in 1933. And I do have a taste for alt history. It's a lot of fun.
Well, the book we're discussing is Dark Victory, a novel of the alien resistance by Brendan DuBois. It's now at booksellers everywhere. Brendan, thank you so much for being with us.
Entirely my pleasure, Tony, and thanks again for taking a chance on me in making a sort of 40-year-old dream come true of having a true science fiction novel published. We're still very excited about it.
Well, a lot of readers are going to be pleased that we did.
Oh, well, great. Thank you so very much.
Now we continue with our complete audiobook serialization of John Ringo's Under a Graveyard Sky. This portion of Under a Graveyard Sky is provided by Audible.com. Get the complete audiobook at Audible.com now. If you're not a subscriber, you can get the entire audiobook free or choose from more than 100,000 other titles when you try Audible free for 30 days. Now here is another segment of John Ringo's novel of zombie infestation and the heroic humans who fight back, determined to pull the world from disaster and humanity itself from the brink of annihilation. It's all taking place under a graveyard sky.
Chapter 22. Fish you caught bait? Steve asked. You want it or no? The 67-foot Bertram convertible had taken a beating from the three zombies that had survived. It looked as if there had originally been six, but according to Stacy, none of the damage was critical, and it was basically a good boat. You missed your calling in life, Blair said, shaking his head at the feces all over the saloon. You should have been a yacht broker. It's going to be a hell of a lot of cleanup. If you don't want it, I'll find somebody who does, Steve said. That's not being a prick, but if you don't take it, somebody will. Sophia would take it like a shot. Oh, I'll take it, Blair said. I'm tired of getting beat to death on the Endeavor. How are you with Sophia taking the Endeavor over? Steve asked. Today? Blair asked. I'd like to take both into Bermuda and get this one cleaned up before changing over. I can live with that, Steve said. Your crew could use some in-harbor time. By the way, if I haven't said this, you're doing a hell of a job. But after? I'm good with Seawolf taking it, Blair said. She's young, but she's good. What about the other captains? You heard the vote the last time, Steve said, shrugging. There's not anybody else with the same level of experience. Not that we've got right now. Maybe later. The problem's going to be a crew. You're the history teacher, Blair said, grinning. That was always a problem for captains. Was before the plague. Good crew, anyway. Watch she doesn't steal yours. Which she probably will, Steve said. Okay, somebody's got to drive this into Bermuda. Then get to work on it. When you're ready to change over, give me a holler. I'll make sure the rest of the captains are good with Seawolf Sophia taking over. Almost got you there, Blair said, smiling. Da, you've got a call from the CFIT, Sophia said over the radio. Gotta go, Steve said. Good luck. He stepped into some shit and shook his boot. Seriously, good luck. Thanks. CFIT, Wolf, Steve said. It was just easier that way. You're gonna need you and Cooper's team on this one, Captain Cheryl said. Big coasty, and I mean big. One of their famous class. More like a destroyer. Oh, crap, Sophia said. Cooper, are you monitoring? Steve called. Roger. Location? 31.915 by 70.752. Roger, Steve said, looking at the spot. Be there in about 3. Cooper will be about 6, Chris sent. Victoria, Wolf, over, Steve said. He sighed and shook his head. Victoria, Wolf, over. Victoria? Tell Victoria actual to expect company, Steve said. Get the lodge warmed up. We may have some customers. Sorry, what? Tell Mike CFIT found a cutter, Steve said carefully. Do you get that? What's a cutter? Is there any possibility I could speak to Mike? Steve said calmly. Yeah, hang on. He's gonna go back to Bermuda and kill everybody, Fontana said. He had his feet kicked up on the helm of the Cooper and was enjoying the radio play. Mild Steve, Chris said, turning the big boat to head to the reported location. The guy who put a gun to Jack Isham's head and pulled back the hammer. Faith says when he gets real polite, it's bad, Fontana said. He's going to flip his lid, Bundy said. Bet you a dollar, Fredette said, trying not to laugh. Where are you going to get a dollar? Bundy asked. We're eventually going to have to work with these jokers, aren't we? Commander Bradburn said, leaning back in the conning chair. Pretty much the whole sub was listening in. There wasn't much else in the way of entertainment. I will not go over there and kill everyone, Steve said calmly. I won't. Human life is precious. At least uninfected human life. You said you wanted to save the world, da? Sophia said, then paused. Da? Yeah, Steve said. What's that? Sophia said, pointing to port. Steve pulled down a pair of binoculars and examined the splash of spray on the horizon. They'd seen whales and even dolphins aplenty in their voyage. Lots of birds, flying fish, but never something scooting along on the surface more or less parallel to them and putting up a wisp of spray. That, Steve said, lowering the binoculars, is interesting. What is it? She asked. What it is something you didn't see, Steve said. Just, we're going to forget we saw it for now. I'll talk to you about it later, okay? Yes, da, Sophia said, looking at him. That is important, Steve said, getting up and walking off of the bridge. Bundy looked at the frequency monitor and ran back a recent recording. Submarine paralleling the Tina's toy. This is Commodore Wolf. Over. Submarine paralleling the Tina's toy. This is Commodore Wolf. Over. Damn, Fredette said. Short-ranged handheld. CO? Damn it, Bradburn said. Apparently they're not quite as incompetent as all that. Thank you, XO, Bradburn said. Drop the aerial. Make your depth 100 meters. Come to course 190. Quarter speed. Bloody hell, Steve snarled as the ESM mast disappeared below the waves. For this I paid my bloody taxes? Okay, this is gonna be a bitch, Steve said, looking up at the massive cutter. There's a real easy place to board on the side, Faith pointed out. At least we're not going to be climbing 10 stories or something. Note the surviving zombies in the helipad, Fontana pointed out. We got anybody but the three of us? Sophia, Steve said. She can be my number two. You guys get things worked out? He's more or less trained, Faith said, absently looking through the binoculars. Fontana and Steve traded a look as they both tried not to laugh. I know you're trying not to laugh, Faith said. Apparently, you don't get dry humor. Yeah, he's good to go, da. I say we come close alongside and try popping them with an AK. You know how well that went the last time, Steve said. I'm pretty sure I've got this rolling thing down, Faith said. The only people who have ever gotten this rolling thing down were the Jedi Knights, Fontana said. Jedi Knights? Faith said, lowering the binos and looking at him in puzzlement. I'm talking for real, not science fiction. It's the nickname of SEAL Team 6, Steve said. Alas, I think Faith is right, but I'm going to try it, and I'll use the M1. I've been to sniper school, Fontana said. Maybe. Sergeant Fontana, Steve said. If anyone is going to kill his crew and sink his boat, it should be the captain. Steve waited until the boat was on the uplift and stroked the trigger. Hi, Fontana said, again. I'd rather be high than low, Steve said, jacking another 7.62 round into the chamber. The weapon was a Springfield Armory M1A, rechambered for a 7.62x39, something that the gunsmith who did it considered very near sacrilege, but Steve was a big believer in ammunition commonality. He just couldn't find any AK variants he considered accurate enough. High means they don't come back at us at high velocity. He waited, then fired again. This time he scored a hit. He's down, Fontana said. Chest hit. The problem was the low rail on the side of the flight deck. It was barely knee-high on the zombies, but it was high enough that the flying deck of the toy was barely at the same level, and it was steel. Hitting it would have the round come back at high velocity. And of course, both boats were rocking in the swells, which weren't minor at the moment. One of the zombies tumbled off the flight deck trying to reach the yacht and splashed into the water. Apparently it wasn't the first time. A shark closed in before the zombie had surfaced. I suppose we could try to lasso them off, Fontana said. No, Steve said. Sophia, he said, keying his radio. Duh? Close approach. As close as you can get and not hit the cutter. Shorter range, more accuracy, Steve said, as the yacht started to pull away for a closer run. And maybe some of them will try to jump. Maybe I should tell Fate that, Fontana said, standing up. Okay, Steve said, taking another zombie down. This is fish in a barrel. More like zombie chumming, Fontana said. You should see the water. The human body, contrary to Hollywood action films, tends to fall face forwards when shot. Some of the zombies had tumbled over. One had tried to jump. She hadn't made it. Most that were shot tumbled over the side. I'm trying not to remind myself that these are U.S. Coast Guard personnel who are merely infected with a horrible plague, Steve said, stroking the trigger. By preference, I'd have preferred to bury them wrapped in flags, not in the belly of a tiger shark. There are probably some survivors who are not zombies, Fontana said. Hopefully they'll understand. Okay, bloody, Steve said. They'd checked three of the on-deck hatches. All were sealed and had some sort of electronic lock on them. They were also quite resistant to a Halligan tool. There's a set of clothes over here, Faith said, picking up the uniform. It's got an ID on it. Would that work? Is it a universal? Fontana asked, taking the ID and examining it. And the answer is yes, he said, pointing to the small chip on the badge. But will it work? Steve asked. No, Fontana said, swiping the badge. The lock remained red. Okay, let's look for others, Steve said. The lockdown may be based on seniority or other access. We'll gather them up and check them all. Try this one, Fontana said, handing it over. A lieutenant's didn't work, Steve said. Why would a chief petty officer's? But when he tried it, the lock went green. It's a coasty thing, Fontana said, shrugging. Navy, too. A chief outranks a lieutenant any day. What's a chief? Faith asked. What's a lieutenant, for that matter? Any zombies? Steve asked, banging on a hatch. He was rewarded by the beginning of shaving a haircut. Close your eyes, Steve shouted. Understand? Close your eyes. He undogged the hatch and tossed in a chem light. Use that to adjust your eyes, Steve said.
Thanks for finally coming, the man at the hatch said. Jesus, where have you guys been?
It's a long story, Steve said. But we're not Coast Guard or Navy, just a volunteer civilian group. You need water?
The worst sort of way, the guy replied. We've been carefully recycling piss for, well, for a long time.
Bottles, Steve said, tossing them through the door. I'm going to keep clearing. I'll be back in about 5. I need to make sure this area's clear.
Roger.
Who's seen you? The respirator-clad man said. The voice was muffled from the respirator, but he had a Commonwealth accent. Bobby couldn't tell which. Possibly Irish. Petty Officer First Class Bobby Kuzma was the senior of the 6 survivors of the USCGC Campbell, WMEC-909, slumping on benches in the crew mess, so he raised his hand. The man was just about covered in lights, which were still painful to Kuzma's eyes. From what little Bobby could see, he was just as covered in armor and weapons, ranging from some sort of AK-variant shotgun to a large hunting knife. He even had the head of a Halligan tool sticking up over his shoulder with the tool in some sort of holster. Another armored figure, a woman from the walk, but it was hard to tell, entered behind him.
I found a cache of sunglasses. Woman. Young. That was all Kuzma could make out. She started to hand them out. A while back, before the world came apart, Bobby would have thought it idiotic to wear sunglasses in the mess. Now, even with the lights off, they were a welcome relief from the lights the members of the group were wearing. The first man shut off a couple of the lights and came over to Bobby. "Need to talk," he said, holding out his hand. "Can you walk?" "I can walk," Bobby said, but he took the hand. The man led him down the crew mess and then pulled off his mask with a grimace. "Eh," the guy said, grimacing. "We use these for the smell. I'd say let's go outside where it's a little better, but I don't think you can handle the light yet." He pulled out a canister of Vicks vapor rub, rubbed it on his nostrils, then held it out to Kuzma. "You get used to it," Bobby said, waving his hand. "Two things," the man said. "More. First, I'm Stephen Smith, Australian by birth, naturalized American citizen, former Aussie para, former history teacher, and currently, and I put quotes on this, commodore of a flotilla of small boats clearing this patch of the Atlantic. I'm called Captain Wolf or Commodore Wolf, and the group has named the flotilla Wolf's Floating Circus. Basically, we range between Bermuda, where we're using a disabled ocean-going tug as a supply base, and the coast of the US. We're actually just around Bermuda right now, because there's only six of us, and one of them's a wanker who isn't worth the cost of fuel. It's an all-volunteer effort, which is a bit like herding roos, which, trust me, are worse than cats. I tried it one time as a lad. So, to what happens next," Smith continued. "The normal next thing is we get you over to the boats, give you a scrub down, and get some chow in you. Usual sort of at-sea rescue thing, except the scrub down part. That was originally because we feared the virus. These days it's because, well, become tradition, and people tend to be ready for a shower."
"Very ready for a shower," Kuzma said carefully.
"And since you were by yourself in the compartment, you need to get used to using your voice again," Steve said, "and light. That takes a few days. I said that was the normal thing we do. The issue here is that this is the biggest boat we've cleared, and it has about 10 bloody million compartments."
"You're not sure it's clear?" Kuzma said.
"I'm fairly sure we got all the zombies," Smith said. "If there are any more survivors, they're not making noise when we do. They could be too weak. Most likely." He shrugged.
"Wait," Kuzma said, looking at the group. "Six? That's it? We had 100 personnel and refugees."
"That explains the children," Smith said. "I'm very sorry for your loss."
"So, are you assisting the Coast Guard?" Kuzma said. "I need to get back in communication. Report in."
"I think I may have missed some of the important bits," Steve said. "Actually, I was waiting for you to get your wits to the point. The point is that there is no Coast Guard. Or rather, you're it. As far as I can determine, based upon radio reports and local conditions, you're now more or less the commander of the United States Coast Guard, which consists of you and those other 5 persons."
"That's," Bobby said, sitting on the table and shaking his head. "That can't be. No."
"I cannot prove it to you at this moment," Smith said, shrugging. "We are in a dark hangar or on a boat in the middle of the ocean. But if there were a Coast Guard, I'd assume they would find and clear their own vessels first just to have the trained personnel. You can feel free to verify it in various ways once you get your feet on the ground. We'll, at some point, get you back to Bermuda. You can see the harbor and the zombies. We find boats, feel free to take one over to the mainland and see for yourself. There are no official governmental broadcasts. There are no land areas not held by infected, and we have thus far found no evidence of formal governmental activity."
"Jesus Christ," Kuzma said, looking at the blood-smeared deck. "How long?"
"It is the 15th of August, Smith said. "I've found some watches amongst the crew's belongings. You can verify that at least."
"Jesus," Bobby said. "That long?"
"Petty officer," Smith said sharply. "As I was saying, we normally let people get their feet under them for a few days, I know you were tired, exhausted, malnourished and dehydrated. But we either get assistance from some, preferably three, of your crew to clear the remainder of the boat, or let it go for now. I'm not saying that it's a requirement, and frankly, I don't see finding any more personnel. Not alive. Did they all zombie? Kuzma asked. Do you really want to know this? Smith asked. Yes, Bobby said. We don't have an accurate count, Smith said. Frankly, we don't keep an accurate count of dead and wounded and methods on large vessels such as this. There aren't enough of us yet to take the time. But no, many were infected. Some appear to have died of the infection or possibly from violence by other infecteds. Many were trapped in compartments without stores. Oh, God, Bobby said, hanging his head again. I don't know if it makes it better or worse for you, Smith said, but at a certain point, many committed suicide, and did so in some very honorable ways. But they did so as an alternative to starvation or dehydration, which, frankly, is why we do this. And we don't count the dead because it takes time, and the living deserve our time more. So the question is, do you wish us to continue the sweep? To do so, we will need assistance. We've swept all we can find. I'll help, Kuzma said, standing up and swaying. As long as I can. I guess asking you to collect the dead? There are currently 126 survivors known to us, Steve said. 132 counting your group, only 46 of which are willing to actively volunteer to the extent of manning boats supplied and supported by us and clearing life rafts. We have an additional 6 or so who are willing to go into cleared vessels to recover materials or get them operational. I have exactly 3 personnel willing to participate in active clearance, fighting zombies in the dark in confined spaces, as it were. 3 more will, if pressed. Would you care to answer your own question, Petty Officer? No, sir, Kuzma said. I mean, yes, sir. I understand. There are literally not enough of us left to bury the dead, Smith said softly. That is the world in which you have been reborn. What you make of that is up to you. How the hell did we miss this area? Said She-Wolf in a muffled voice. Kuzma's clearance specialist was a 13-year-old girl, tall for her age, tall for a girl, period, and clearly strong. She was carrying about 100 pounds of weapons, ammo, and gear, but still, a 13-year-old girl. The layout of this boat is screwy, Kuzma said weakly. He leaned up against a bulkhead for a second. He knew he'd get his strength back eventually, but lagging behind a 13-year-old girl who was weighed down like an infantryman was embarrassing. The design looked great on paper, but it's not what you call efficient. Okay, She-Wolf said, banging on the hatch. Zombies, zombies, zombies! Hello? You sure about that? Kuzma said, his eyes wide. Let them come to you, the girl said. Bring them into your zone of fire. Don't go into theirs. There was an odd thump from the door. Then more. And we have a winner, She-Wolf said. I need you to back up into that cross corridor. In fact, I need you to back way the fuck up.
Why?
The petty officer asked. Because if there's a bunch, I'm going to have to back up, the girl said. And you're not moving real quick. So back way the fuck up, and around the corner so you're less likely to get hit by bouncers. Kuzma backed into the cross corridor, flashing a light around to make sure there weren't zombies there. He had a pistol, but he wasn't sure that he could even raise it, much less shoot straight. God, he was tired. Thinking about what the girl had said, he backed farther into the corridor. The bouncer's point was important. Ali Ali Oxenfree, come to mama. Kuzma heard the hatch undog, then slam back on its latches. Fudgesicle, the girl shouted, followed by a series of rapid-fire shotgun blasts. She-Wolf backed into the cross corridor, dropped her shotgun on its harness, and drew her pistol with lightning speed. Say hello to my little friend, she shouted, double-tapping.
She pivoted into the corridor, backing towards Kuzma, clearly covering him. You want some? Infected came around the corner after her, lunging at her as she expertly double-tapped. The worst thing for Kuzma was that he recognized most of them. Some of them were refugees that Campbell had been ordered to rescue in the early days of the plague. They were probably how the plague had gotten on board. Others were fellow crew members, bearded, filthy, naked, covered in sores, feces, vomit, and dried and fresh blood. Houston P. Barnes, who had just reported to the Campbell before the outbreak, but whom he'd known for years. He had bits of flesh in his unkempt beard, and then his face buckled under when the second 45 round hit him. Tommy E. Craddock Jr. Don't forget the junior. One of his closest messmates. He clutched at the round that hit him in the chest, howling the weird cry of a wounded zombie, half keen, half snarl, then was stopped by another round to the forehead, which left a round blue hole. You gonna back up or not? She-Wolf screamed. She-Wolf screamed. Her pistol locked back, so she tossed it forward onto a dead body and ripped another from her chest holder. The plethora of weapons was starting to make sense. Bobby couldn't back up, couldn't lift his own weapon. All he could do was stare mutely at the black tide pouring down the corridor. And then it was done. A refugee was the last, dropping more or less right in front of him. So fixated on the light-covered girl, she hadn't even noticed the frozen petty officer. That was almost too exciting, the girl said. She reloaded both her weapons, retrieved the dropped pistol, reloaded that, then hefted her shotgun. Real zombie apocalypse moment there. You done with your break? I think I'm done, Kuzma said. I think I'm just done. Bobby sat on the flying deck of the toy, watching the dinghy coming back from the Campbell. He'd been in similar dinghies hundreds of times, doing inspections of boats just like this one. In fact, he was pretty sure they'd done a stop on this boat. But when they were done, they went back to the cutter. They always went back to the cutter. This time, he wasn't going back. He was never going back. After the scene in the corridor, he was never, ever going back. Not love, nor money, nor orders could make him go back aboard the WMEC 909, United States Coast Guard Cutter Campbell, Queen of the Seas. He wished he had a harpoon missile to sink her like her previous namesake. You gonna be okay? Captain Smith asked, sitting down next to him. I hear you had a little ZA moment. That's your daughter? Kuzma asked, tonelessly. She-Wolf was riding back in the dinghy, second on, last off. The helmsman must have said something funny because the 13-year-old girl was grinning with her fine, blonde, blood-splattered hair blowing in the freshening wind. Yes. Is she okay? Kuzma asked. I mean, do you mean is she freaked out by what happened? Smith asked. She said it was almost worse than New York, but not quite. If you mean is she insane, she was a fairly normally adjusted girl before the plague. She never threatened to bomb her school or shoot it up. She played soccer and was starting to date. She chased boys, sometimes literally. But she'd always quip that the worst thing about a zombie apocalypse would be pretending you weren't excited by the prospect. So, she was fairly well adjusted to the previous world. She is well adjusted to this one. So yes, she is okay. She's even sensitive, which is hard in this job. She hates to shoot the children, and lets others do it when possible. I take it you're not okay. No, Kuzma said. Not okay. Glad to be out of there. Just glad to be out. I am sorry that you observed the termination of your shipmates, Smith said. That is a very close bond. I had to shoot some myself, getting to the store's locker, Bobby admitted. But that was bad. A large group of apparently uninfected had locked down in another store's locker, Smith said, and then, apparently, had taken insufficient precautions to prevent spread. And then
eaten each other? Bobby asked. More or less, Smith said. Which was why there were so many survivors. Zombie survivors, that is. I take it you don't want to participate in the salvage operation. Salvage? Kuzma said. You can't salvage a U.S. Coast Guard cutter. And there were survivors on board, Smith said, nodding. But salvage it we must. For the small arms locker, if nothing else. Petty officer, I left New York with 7,000 rounds of double-aught buckshot and 1,000 rounds of frangible. For what I had originally planned, that would have been more than enough. For this, I'm down to 4,000 rounds. I'm halfway through my supply, more or less, and I have an ocean of ships and boats to clear. I can find diesel, food, water from recyclers, even parts. But munitions? Weapons? If not from your storage locker, then where? That's a tall order, Kuzma said, breathing out hard. I mean, will we help? Yeah, of course. But turning over the contents of a 270 to civilians? If there ever is a Coast Guard again, I can't see them not hanging my ass for that. Well? I already purloined one thing from your boat, Steve said. Step out on the foredeck with me, Petty Officer. Steve and Kuzma walked up to the front of the boat, and Steve pulled out a Coast Guard walkie-talkie. I presume this doesn't use civilian frequencies? Steve asked, holding it up. No, sir, the PO said, his brow furrowing. U.S. Navy, this is Commodore Wolf on Coast Guard frequency. I know you're not going to talk to me, but will you talk to a Coast Guard petty officer? Here's PO 1 Kuzma. Spelling, Kilo, Uniform, Zulu, Mike, Alpha. Turning over now. It might take a bit, Steve said. He handed Kuzma the radio and walked aft. What now? Schultz asked. Get me the hole, Bradburn replied.
That was another segment in our complete audiobook serialization of Under a Graveyard Sky by John Ringo. And that's it for the podcast. Thanks to Audible.com, to Bane intern Rachel Mintel, and to podcast theme composer Ruth Judkowitz, and a New Hampshire autumnal cascade of colorful leaves, each labeled with a separate message of thanks and gratitude, plus, just for the heck of it, a heat blaster taken from that alien spaceship that crash-landed in Anniston, Alabama in 1975. Hey, I was there, and who wouldn't collect a souvenir? All of this to Brendan Dubois, author of Dark Victory. Please join us next time here at the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy. And keep reaching for the stars. The Bane Free Radio Hour is brought to you by Bane Books Audio Drama, presenting dramatized audio plays of the best science fiction and fantasy with a professional cast and cinema quality soundtracks. Now available, Eric Flint's Islands, based on the novella by Eric Flint. Also available, Larry Correa's Detroit Christmas, based on the novella by Larry Correa. Set in the world of the Grimnoir Chronicles at BaneEbooks.com. Just put Islands and Detroit Christmas in the search bar and enter a world of listening pleasure. Bane Books Audio Drama.